Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Ninth Circuit Jury Instruction Edition. Today our featured guest is Baker Hostetler partner Lee Casey, discussing Waddington v. Sourasad and Hedgepeth v. Polito, heard in oral argument on Wednesday, October 15th. Thanks for tuning in. The Supreme Court here considers two federal habeas review cases from the Ninth Circuit involving jury instructions. Waddington centers on the issue of whether the jury that convicted Cesar Sourasad of second-degree murder, attempted murder, and assault was instructed properly on Washington State's accomplice liability law. State court that heard Sourasad's challenge upheld the conviction, but the Ninth Circuit affirmed the district court's grant of federal habeas relief, finding a reasonable likelihood the jury had unconstitutionally misapplied their instructions to relieve the state of its burden of proof. The Supreme Court thus considers what deference the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act requires federal courts to give to state court determinations concerning jury instructions. Hedgepeth concerns Michael Polito's conviction by an erroneously instructed jury who found a special circumstance of robbery felony murder. The California Supreme Court affirmed the conviction by applying modern harmless error jurisprudence, but the Ninth Circuit considered the instructional error to be structural and affirmed again the district court's grant of federal habeas relief. So the Supreme Court now considers whether clearly established federal law precludes the Ninth Circuit's grant of habeas relief. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the Speaker. And now, Mr. Casey.
On October 15, 2008, the Supreme Court heard argument in two erroneous jury instruction cases, Waddington v. Sourasad and Hedgepeth v. Polito. It's best to begin a discussion of the Sourasad case by noting that for a number of years, there was uncertainty in Washington State about the correct mens rea standard for accomplice liability. The statute suggested that an accomplice must have intended to facilitate the crime. The law, however, was often interpreted to require merely that an accomplice intend to facilitate a crime, not necessarily the offense with which the defendant was later charged. The Washington Supreme Court cleared this up in 2001 when it ruled that accomplice liability would attach only where the defendant actually had knowledge of the offense charged. He would not, in other words, be strictly liable for any criminal conduct of the relevant principle. Well before this standard was clarified, Cesar Sourasad was involved in a gang killing in Seattle. He drove a car from which another gang member shot and killed a student, wounding another at a rival high school. Sourasad was convicted of second-degree murder as an accomplice. The trial judge instructed the jury on accomplice liability essentially by providing the statutory language from which it was certainly possible to conclude that knowledge of the crime charged rather than just any crime which may have occurred was required. The jury, however, was clearly uncertain about the correct standard and asked the court no fewer than three times for clarification of that standard, although their questions did not make clear that the difference between the crime or a crime was the problem. In addition, during her closing argument, the prosecutor appears to have argued for the broader standard, using the language, quote, in for a dime, in for a dollar, unquote, which may have suggested to the jury that this was the correct legal standard. And, of course, this was one or was a standard that was well supported at the time, although not universally or uniformly accepted. In the event, Sourasad was convicted of second-degree murder. The Washington Court of Appeals agreed that the jury instruction was based on an in-for-a-dime, in-for-a-dollar theory of accomplice liability, but also concluded that this was the correct legal standard under Washington law. 3 years later, the Washington Supreme Court finally resolved the issue, rejecting this rule, and Sourasad sought additional review before the Washington Court of Appeals on this ground. The court, however, denied relief, concluding that even if its previous decision misinterpreted Washington law, because the trial court's actual instruction had mirrored the applicable statute, the jury had nevertheless been instructed properly. Sourasad then sought federal habeas review. Ultimately, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit concluded that he had established a, quote, reasonable likelihood that the jury has applied the challenged instruction in a way that violates the Constitution, unquote. In this case, that violation would have been an application of the standard in a manner otherwise inconsistent with Washington state law, which, as the Washington State Supreme Court had stated, rejected the notion of accomplice liability for any criminal offense, rather than only for those defendant knew his compatriots were planning. Because of this, it concluded the state had been improperly relieved of its burden of proving an element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. The Supreme Court granted certiorari and took up the question whether the Ninth Circuit had properly applied the relevant federal habeas standard under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 in this instance. That is, whether it correctly determined that the Washington courts, applying a highly deferential standard, had applied clearly established federal law in a manner that was objectively unreasonable. At oral argument on October 15th, the justices generally focused on the question whether the accomplice instruction as given was sufficient to inform the jury of the correct standard, regardless of the prevailing state of judicial opinion at that time. They were by no means divided along ideological lines. Justice Scalia was skeptical, telling the state's counsel that, quote, "I don't know how you get from the text of the Washington statute that all you have to know is that it was a homicide," unquote, also noting that the jury clearly seemed perplexed over the correct standard here since it asked for clarification three times. Reading the statute or instruction, Justice Scalia continued, does not help a lot. It doesn't clarify. It doesn't correct any misimpression that the prosecutor could have created. Justice Ginsburg clearly agreed on this point, noting that the jury did not get an answer to its question. Quote, "They were told to read the instruction that they had been told to read three times and obviously didn't understand." An equally skeptical Justice Souter also raised the prosecutor's closing argument, in which she appeared to argue for an in-for-a-dime, in-for-a-dollar approach to the standard. He suggested that the argument could have gone either way, some of it suggesting that the defendant had to know of the crime charge, and some that knowledge of any intended offense was sufficient. And in the circumstances, quote, "it seems to me that the benefit of the doubt goes to the defendant," unquote. Justice Breyer, on the other hand, noted that even if the prosecutor did get the jury mixed up on this point, the confusion would have had to have been substantial, i.e. more than was evident here, before a due process violation would have occurred. In addition, while questioning Sauerstedt's counsel, he noted that, "I have read the instruction and the statute probably over a dozen times by now. I can't find the slightest ambiguity. It seems absolutely clear." Chief Justice Roberts noted, also questioning the defendant's counsel, that if you can read the instruction both ways, it is hard to say that the correct version, as held by the Washington courts, was objectively unreasonable. For his part, Sauerstedt's counsel concentrated on the fact that the jury deliberated for 7 days, although, as the state's counsel pointed out, there were several defendants, and asked for clarification on the standard for accomplice liability three times and was simply told over and again to reread the instruction. Chief Justice Roberts affirmed that standard of review, that there must be an unreasonable application of a clearly established federal law, and that the instruction itself was simply insufficient for objectively unreasonable because it can be, in fact, read correctly. That is, to require knowledge of the crime charged. With that, the case was submitted. The second case, Hedgeheth against Toledo, also involved a challenge to jury instructions, although in this case the instruction given was clearly flawed. Respondent Michael Pulido was convicted of murder and robbery. He had helped to rob a gas station in San Mateo, California, and the attendant was killed during the robbery. The trial court's instruction permitted conviction for felony murder on the basis of involvement in the robbery even after the murder took place, and there was some issue about when Pulido became involved. This was clearly incorrect under California law, which requires a finding of contemporaneity in such cases. However, the California Supreme Court affirmed the conviction because the jury had also entered a special circumstance finding, which the court concluded itself required the necessary contemporaneous participation. Thus, the defective instruction was harmless error, and the conviction was affirmed. Respondent then collaterally attacked his conviction through pro se habeas proceedings. The district court concluded that the error was prejudicial, as did the Ninth Circuit on appeal. In addition, the Ninth Circuit concluded that the special circumstance instruction had also been defective, a point the state by then conceded, undermining the critical finding that petitioner had aided and abetted the robbery before or at the same time as the victim's murder and not afterwards. Because the jury instructions left open the possibility that the jury convicted Pulido on a legally impermissible theory, namely that the defendant joined the robbery only after the victim was killed, the court determined that the error was structural, and since it could not determine with absolute certainty that the defendant was not convicted on an erroneous theory, habeas relief was appropriate. California petitioned for certiorari, arguing that the very high standard for habeas relief established by the AEDPA had not been met here because the instructional error in this case was not structural, to which the harmless error rule cannot apply. It argued that the Ninth Circuit had misapplied the Supreme Court's decision in Stromberg against California from 1931, which stands for the proposition that when a provision of the Constitution forbids conviction on a particular ground, the constitutional guarantee is violated by a general verdict that may have rested on that ground. The state's position was that the rule did not apply where an alternative legal theory of guilt was at issue. The state also argued that the Ninth Circuit's structural error analysis was inconsistent with the rule in several other circuits where harmless error is recognized in incorrect jury instruction cases, as well as the Supreme Court's own harmless error precedents. This was true especially of Brecht versus Abrahamson, a 1993 case where the court articulated the harmless error test as whether the error had a, quote, substantial and injurious effect or influence in determining the jury's verdict, unquote, rather than the absolute certainty analysis the Ninth Circuit applied in this case. The United States chose to participate and supported California as amicus curiae. At oral argument, California agreed that Brecht was also the correct standard, but disputed its application in this case. In this connection, the state argued that the respondent's version of Brecht amounted to application of an error test. Did the jury rely on a valid or invalid theory rather than a harmless error test? That what would the jury have done and would it have made a difference for the defendant if it had been properly instructed? The state urged that on remand the Supreme Court make clear that these analyses were to be kept separate. From the state's perspective, of course, because the jury did determine based on other findings that petitioner had been involved in the robbery at the time of the murder and not afterwards, the incorrect instructions were harmless error. For his part, respondent agreed that the Ninth Circuit's application of Stromberg was incorrect and that the correct standard that should have been applied was one of harmless error under Brecht. However, his counsel argued that regardless of what the Ninth Circuit called it in terms of structural error, both the district court and that panel had actually performed a case-specific inquiry, which left both uncertain of whether the jury relied on an invalid legal theory in convicting. In effect, this applied the Brecht standard for harmless error and resulted in a correct finding of injurious error, and therefore habeas relief being appropriate. For its part, the United States argued that the court should make clear that the Ninth Circuit had misapplied Stromberg and that the type of error at issue here was not structural and was subject to the harmless error test. The court should, therefore, the solicitor argued, remand the case with instructions that the Ninth Circuit apply the Brecht standard. This, Justice Ginsburg pointed out, is in fact exactly what the district court had done, apply the harmless error standard under Brecht. However, the government also argued that the court should clarify two points. First, that the question is not what the jury may actually or necessarily have found, but rather it encompasses what a rational jury would have found absent the error. And second, that harmless error review is not limited to cases where the relevant elements are undisputed, but rather even when disputed, a reviewing court should consider the entire record and determine whether, in light of the jury finding, there is sufficient evidence to support a contrary verdict. During argument, a number of justices, including Justices Souter, Ginsburg, Stevens, and Kennedy, focused on California's theory of harmless error. That is, because the special circumstance finding required some finding of contemporaneous participation, that this was sufficient to support the verdict under a correct legal theory. The justices pointed out that the special circumstance instruction also was defective, however, containing a typographical error, substituting an or for an and could have led the jury to find the special circumstance without the required finding of contemporaneous action. In response, the state pointed to other findings that did require this contemporaneous element and would foreclose, at least arguably, a finding that the respondent was responsible for the murder, even though his involvement in the robbery took place after the fact. The issue, however, was ultimately summed up by the Chief Justice when he noted that, quote, "I thought the case was about whether or not the Ninth Circuit erred in concluding that harmless error analysis didn't apply to a Strongberg structural error," close quote. Both Justice Breyer and the Chief suggested that the case should be remanded to the Ninth Circuit for application of the correct Brecht standard, to which the respondent did not object. And this appears, therefore, to be the likely result of the case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.